This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Crime in humility, I will listen. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living in the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. On this journey through thoughts and feelings, finding intuition, my head, my heart, I am gathering the tools together. I'm preparing to do my part. All of those who have come before me, band together and be my guide. Loving lessons that I will follow. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living neath the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will recognizing that we've arrived. Loving spirits will live together. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living neath the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side.
Mike's great. Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, and 100.7 FM Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, for all of our listeners around the world on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. I'm Marvin, along with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
And today we have a co-host with us, Arlene Edwards.
Good morning.
Great. Arlene's a Vietnam vet. She was a nurse in Vietnam in 68, 69.
Yep.
And we interviewed her a few years ago.
2 years ago.
2 years ago. And that song that you just heard is called, called Swimming to the Other Side, and it's by Pat Humphreys. And that came off an album that my friend Joe Lewis gave me yesterday. It's from Kent State May 4th CD project. And Joe Lewis yesterday spoke at Laurel's class. And as you know, we interviewed Joe and a long time ago, and he was one of the students shot at Kent State. And he talked to these kids at Laurel's class, and very interesting. Those kids really, really listened to what Joe had to say. And he did a wonderful job. And Joe's a great guy, and I consider him a good friend.
He's a wonderful person.
Oh, he's just a wonderful person. And he said yesterday that he was interested in going to Vietnam with me, so on my next trip. So that's going to be nice, because when the Kent State shootings happened, the people of Vietnam were, boy, in solidarity with those kids. And if I remember right, they made a postage stamp about Kent State. If I remember right, I'm pretty sure they did. Lady Borton would know for sure. So to get going here, I'm trying to get everything going. Our guest today is Dale Maharidge, and he's the author of Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War. And Dale's going to talk about his father and some other Marines that were in his father's platoon who fought in the Pacific Islands during World War II. And how they felt about the war is kind of different than, you know, what we've been told all of our life about this war, Second World War. This is the first time, isn't it, Bill, we've done a show on World War II?
As I recall.
Yeah. I don't ever remember us doing another show, because I never found a book I liked on it until this book. And like I said, it's called Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War by Dale Maharidge. And Dale, I want to thank you for coming on our show.
Well, I'm really glad to be here.
Oh, it's our pleasure, buddy. It's our pleasure. Your book, like I was saying, it's the only book I've read on World War II that I even considered, you know, talking about on our show, because most of the books, you know, deal with it in a different manner than your book does. And your father, can you talk a little bit about your father before we start?
Yeah, my father, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and my father would have these sudden bursts of rage. He was a great guy most of the time, but then he would just explode. And early on, I connected it with the war. There was a picture that he had in the basement where he had a shop of him and another fella. And he never talked about the guy. Early on, he said, you know, from Guadalcanal, I was taken on Guadalcanal. And as time went on, he told me when he was on meds after a drunk driver hit him, they blamed me for killing him, but I didn't kill him.
Wow.
And I would work with my dad in his shop, and the rages, a lot of times I noticed, happened to do what he was talking about, the war. So I connected at an early age that it was war related. I would later find out that he suffered traumatic brain injury in the Battle of Okinawa, two major blast concussions. That I found, and it explains a lot of why he was the way he was. But of course, as a kid, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, because my dad was a World War II veteran. He fought in North Africa and Italy as an infantryman also. And my father was, when I was reading your book, Dale, a lot of the stuff that your father did, my father did too, you know. And
oh, yeah.
And I think a lot of those World War II vets were never treated for their PTSD. You know, they just
Wasn't recognized.
No, it wasn't recognized, and so they never got any treatment. And they went through their lives, you know, suffering from the effects of the war had on them, and it affected families. So, I want to ask you, your father, explain exactly what your father did in World War II.
He was in the U.S. Marines. He first fought in Oneitok, a very short battle. They went to Guadalcanal into the staging area, and then he was involved in the Battle of Guam and then the Battle of Okinawa. On Guam, his unit was put right in front of a Japanese company that was trapped.
Yes.
500 Japanese soldiers on a peninsula. Colonel Schisler, I later found out from several men in the company, basically it was a suicide mission. They put him right in front of these guys who were trying to escape. That night was mayhem. All the guys on either side of my dad were dead. My dad had a shrapnel wound in the back from a mortar round, nearly bled out. And, of course, in World War II, you got wounded. They didn't send you home. You got healed up. You got put right back in.
Mm-hmm.
So then he went to Okinawa and was there for the Battle of Okinawa, where that was brutal and nasty.
Mm-hmm. It sure was.
A quarter million people died on that island. civilians, Japanese soldiers, and American soldiers.
What interests me is your father seemed to not want to really talk about the war, not to really want to describe his feelings about the war. Did that change as he got older?
It started to change as he got older, but one thing I want to say
Go
early
ahead.
On is none of the I found 29 guys from his company after he died, including my father. None of them ever called it the Good War. None of them ever referred to themselves as heroes. My father often said, he says, but I would talk about, you know, what he did was pretty big, and he said, there are no heroes. You just survive.
Yeah.
But yeah, he started talking about the war as he got older, and then he died at age 75, and I learned something after I began my quest after he died to learn what happened to him, that the guys, as they hit their late 70s and 80s, started opening up. It's like I couldn't have gotten this story if I'd done it 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One guy in particular told me, you're the first person I've ever talked to with about the war, ever.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. So when your book, Bringing Mulligan Home, we're going to talk about Mulligan here soon, but what made you really decide to follow this story about your father? You know what? I mean, I know it's what you saw. I read the book, so I know. But you had that picture of him. Your father was having trouble from the war. And what made you decide to say, well, I'm going to find out about Mulligan? What clicked?
When my father died, when a parent passes, you have all this weird energy. I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for 35 years now,
yeah.
I believe.
Good.
And I decided I'm going to find out what happened to him in that war because it dominated his life. I knew, and over the period of time, he would talk occasionally about it with me. I knew enough to know that it was really bad on him, what really happened to him, what happened to the mysterious guy in the picture. And so that's when I began the quest in 2000. We buried him at Arlington Cemetery. And he had a Purple Heart because of that wound, and I got obsessed. I made hundreds and hundreds, actually thousands of phone calls to guys from the muster rolls, trying to track down as many as I could to see what happened to the man in the picture, but also, as I went on, what really happened in that war, because it's been glorified and mythologized as everything that was done was great, we were heroes, and you know, in the Pacific, at least, I have a lot of friends who are Vietnam vets. I just miss Vietnam. I'm a little younger than you.
Than
guys.
Me.
Than us. Yes.
Me and Arlene.
barely missed it. And so I have a lot of older friends who went there, and I found out that the World War II guys who were in the Pacific have a lot in common with the Vietnam guy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes. Especially these fellows that you interviewed.
Yeah.
And women, too, of course.
Oh, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Of
yeah.
course.
Yeah.
The men in the company, in your father's platoon, your father was a rifleman. He was a rifleman in an infantry company. And everybody in that platoon was an infantryman. And like you were saying, which was I thought was really interesting, is that every one of them didn't think that they had that the islands were a good idea to go island hopping. Is that am I remembering it right?
Oh yeah,
talk about
island
that.
Hopping. Yeah, the strategy of Admiral Nimitz. There were two theaters of battle in the Pacific: Admiral Nimitz and Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur coming up the Central Pacific, and mm-hmm. Nimitz coming in from the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And he went basically island to island, head to head combat with the Japanese. MacArthur, he called it hit 'em where they ain't.
Mm-hmm.
He would try to go around the Japanese. Early on in Papua New Guinea, he made a 1,400-mile leap. He basically bypassed the Japanese. They expected him to do exactly what Nimitz was doing, head-on combat. So he bypassed 250,000 Japanese soldiers and just moved north. Now, of course, he had to do battle in the Philippines and other places,
mm-hmm.
but he tried to minimize soldiers' losses, where the guys in the company... Over and over, I heard, they didn't care about us. They put us on these islands. We never bomb the airfields. Go around them. I don't know. I did deep research, and nobody's really critically looked at Nimitz's strategy, I feel. The few books that I found were done by, there was one fellow who followed MacArthur, and I'm spacing on his name right now. But he did a really interesting book in 1954. Fraser Hunt was his name.
That's right. Fraser Hunt. You mentioned that in your book.
Yes. And it's a real interesting take on the so-called good war, where how it was fought was not really good for our soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Or for the civilians.
Oh, my God.
No, and you mentioned that.
Yeah, you talked a lot about civilians.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. On Okinawa, we naval shells and the guys in my dad's company weren't shooting civilians. It was the naval shells and aerial bombs. 150,000 civilians died in the Battle of Okinawa.
And that's a small island, relatively speaking.
It's 60 miles long and 5-10 miles wide.
Yeah. I mean, my gosh.
It's a lot of people in a small place.
My gosh, that's just horrible. And so the men in your father's company, none of them thought it was a good idea. They had a very high casualty rate in the company, and your father continued to be in the war. I mean, he continued to have to fight, and that just had to devastate your father's psyche. It just had to devastate him.
Oh my gosh! I mean, what I found out after he died from the guys who were in the trench in the foxholes right next to him, near him. I mean. In cinematic detail, the guys talked about some of the horrors.
Yes, and yes.
So I learned. I understand a lot more about my dad now. Why he was the way he was. Actually, frankly, guys, I'm surprised he was as normal as he was after what he went through.
Mm. Yeah, I thought it was interesting the way you weaved the chronicle of your mother's life in this marriage.
Yeah.
And what happened with the family. And you also mentioned more than once about your father's screaming at the picture or when he was really angry, trying to repeat words that he apparently used on some of his fellow Marines who were crying and terrified. And I've thought about that a lot, Dale, as I read through the book, because I got to thinking that maybe your dad was screaming so that he didn't have to hear his own screams, metaphorically speaking, you know. That as long as he did that, he didn't have to hear himself.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that generation, get over it. Just get over it.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, you don't get over something like that.
Nope.
Both from just a mental perspective and also if you have
physical.
Brain injury,
yes.
these things called axons in your brain actually snap.
Yes.
They calcify. And rage is talk to the experts, the rage is one common reaction.
A brain injury. Yep.
So when they, go ahead,
Dale. I knew that, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, she was a nurse, so she knew it.
I'm a nurse, and I've suffered a mild brain injury, so yeah.
Oh my
I know.
Gosh.
I think all of us in a war at one time or another suffers to minor brain
concussions
injuries.
Concussions and
Yeah, concussions and different stuff. But in Vietnam, we never thought about it. Korea?
No.
Didn't think of nobody
no,
thought
of I was just thinking, you know, that I lived through World War II. I was 16 when it ended. And I was thinking, as Dale was talking about, the effect that this has, generally speaking, on the general population and how it changes our nation. These guys in World War II, when they came home, didn't want to admit that they were affected. It was just a job that they had to do, and then they came home and took up where they left off when they went to war,
mm-hmm.
And that's just not the case.
Yeah,
and as we're discovering more and more with our military adventurism and the discomfort and the malaise in the country.
Yeah, right now it's really a problem. I want to ask Dale, in your book, it's called Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War. And who was the very first person that you contacted in your father's platoon?
Well, my dad had a Japanese captured silk flag with 22 names on it, signed by guys from the company.
Mm-hmm.
So I started there. And it was deceptively easy. I found Ed Hoffman in Minnesota, who remembered my dad. I said my name, and he said, Steve.
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, he just passed away. And mm-hmm. he said, oh, I wish I could have seen him again. And Ed was critical. I spent a lot of time talking to Ed on the phone. I drove to Minnesota, met with Ed, spent a couple of days with him and his wife, and it was just great. But he gave me the muster rolls from the unit, and that's where I started calling the 400 names that were on those rolls. But everyone wasn't as easy to get or to talk to as Ed. Some guys, it was very, very difficult.
Mm. What did Ed have to say about his feelings about fighting on the islands in the Pacific during the war?
So every guy was different. Ed said, I don't have any problems.
Wow.
And I mean, several guys told me, I just came home and did my thing. And Ed went to Korea as well.
Wow.
He was in reserves. He got both. And I said, how'd you get so lucky? And he said, you have your dad's sense of humor. Ed's a great guy.
Your dad's sense of humor.
Yeah.
That's fun. But he said...
You got to have a dark sense of humor when you're going through that kind of stuff.
Oh, I'm sure. So he said... while you were talking with him about what happened to him and your father and all the other guys, did he talk about it? Did he talk about any incidents or anything that happened about any person?
Well, the thing was, Ed came into Okinawa battle late. He came in at Naha, the last days of the battle, and he said your dad was a sergeant, but he wasn't with us down there. And that's because of the tomb, the final blast concussion. My dad was taken out of the company, and they didn't put these things in the records, but I found enough guys where, I can't say with absolute certainty, but he was given rear duty. Because he'd been through so much. The blast concussions, he was in a bad, bad, bad way. So he wasn't there in those last... So they didn't fight side by side. So I didn't have any of those stories. I got other guys, though, those stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dale, one thing I noticed as I read through your book is I thought that there were many stories within your story.
Oh.
That, you know, obviously the fellows that you interviewed, but the story of your family, the story of the trauma that you experienced during the research to do the book.
Oh, yeah.
And then the story of the true message of war.
Yeah.
And the history. I could go on and on. Mm-hmm. I found about 9 stories within the story. It takes great talent to do that.
Well, the guys were opened up to me. It was really the guys who did that.
Yeah.
But Arlene, these guys, to a man, I did not ask this question. I did not want to make this book political. That wasn't my goal.
No, mm-hmm. no.
To a man, most of these guys are not conservative, mind you. These guys are pretty darn, not liberal. They're conservative. They're one guy, might have been a Democrat, but they're Republican.
Middle of the road.
To a man, they ask, why are we in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I read that. Yeah, all of them did. Yeah, they all asked that. Why are we in Iran and Iraq? And I'm sure that a lot of them had really trouble with Vietnam. Your father? Did he ever say anything about it?
Well, he never talked to me about it, but after he died, the guy who bought his business told me when he was training him, he said, if a war comes, I'm driving my sons to Canada.
Yes.
Yeah, I read that.
What a guy.
That,
what a man.
That's great.
Jeez.
Well, Tom Price in the book, I'm going to see actually next week. I'm going to Los Angeles to talk about the book.
Mm.
Tom Price in my dad's company had a grandson who wanted to enlist and go to Iraq and fight.
Mm.
And he told him, don't.
Don't go.
You don't want that.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. So let's talk about... Arlene really brought up something that interests me, and that was the effect that the war had on your mother, and the way that your mother and your father dealt with each other, and the way your mother dealt especially with your father.
Yeah.
Well, my father would have his explosions. See, my mother just thought he was crazy, and she would fight back. She wasn't passive at all. So our house became bedlam. She would... basically do combat with him in our house, and verbal combat, and
was it scary for you kids when you were kids? Was it scary when you were a little guy? When you guys,
gosh, yeah, terrifying.
Yeah.
As I got older, when it would blow up, we'd all start yelling. I would just get out of there. I'd go to the woods behind the house
mm-hmm.
for hours and just walk, just to get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think, what was the triggers that would shut your father off?
In hindsight, loud noises, surprising things, like one of his kids would spill a glass of water at the table.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I told this, I didn't put this in the book. There was just so many incidents and I couldn't put them all in.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of emails from the sons and daughters of veterans. Mm-hmm. Say, that's my father.
Mm-hmm.
One time I told on the email just a couple weeks ago, I said one of his kids left the cap half cocked on the bottle of ketchup. My dad went to shake it and it flew off and a little bit of ketchup came out. Boom, he would blow up. Mm-hmm. Anything surprising like that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I've talked to other guys in the company, the kids, loud noises, surprises would send their fathers into different, you know, either rages or states of uncomfortableness. And again, that's a symptom of blast concussion.
Sure.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Did your father ever tear up or get misty-eyed?
Just once.
Ooh.
That time he was on meds after the drunk driver nearly killed him.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when he looked at the picture on the wall, the mysterious guy.
Yes.
At that point, I didn't know who he was. And that's when he said, they blame me, but I didn't kill him. I came in with his .45 that night, but it wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. And that's the only time I ever saw my dad emotional in ever.
Wow. Mm-hmm. We're listening. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. We're talking with Dale Maharidge about it, the author of the book "Bringing Mulligan Home: The Other Side of the Good War," and we're talking to Dale a lot about the emotions that his father went through and some of the battles that his father went through, and some of the people that Dale contacted from his father's platoon that he could find. One of the things I want to ask about is, it was the man that nobody liked.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk about that guy?
Guy named Kennedy.
Yeah.
Yep.
I grew up hearing about Kennedy. I worked my father in his shop, and he talked about this guy he both loathed and admired. It was very confusing for me as a kid. He was from Park Avenue, New York City, money. And my father was working class, the Great Depression, poverty, and he wanted money. And he saw Kennedy as epitomizing money in America. At the same time, early on, maybe age 10, 11, 12, I heard my father talk about how he raped a woman, an Okinawan woman. And he loathed that. It was the real weird duality there of hearing about this guy. So I start looking for the guys in my dad's company. And actually, Fenton Greenert from Vancouver, Washington, right across the river from you.
Yeah, from us.
Yeah.
Got to know Fenton really well. He just passed about a year ago. And what a guy he was. But I early on, Fenton told me about this guy. And then I was up, I think it was my second visit to Vancouver, interviewing Fenton. And he told about how this guy also killed two babies, shot him in the head, point blank. He told Fenton, if you try to stop me, I'll kill you. And Fenton was just bawling. Just tears coming out of when he told me this story 65 years later.
Yes.
So anyway, long story short, I hear from other guys about the rape and just a nasty guy this guy was.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't looked for him. It was sort of like I was blotting him. Well, I started making phone calls and I found him.
Mm.
Never forget the day I called him. I said, "Is this the Kennedy who was on Okinawa in World War II?" I said my name and he said, "Steve," my father's name. He was 5'9". He starts going off in this riff about my father, describing him perfectly. And then suddenly, "Who are you? Why are you calling?" He got real defensive. "I never answer this phone. I never answer it. My legs are bad." So I said, "Well, I want to send you this picture of my father and this other fellow. You might remember him. I'm trying to find out what happened to him." "I don't remember anything," he said. "Well, it cost me a stamp. Let me send it." So I sent the picture. 2 weeks later, I call. It was, "Dale, buddy, come on, why don't you come visit?"
Wow.
Complete
totally
turnaround. Yeah.
And the reason he was like that, I realized, I mentioned in my letter, I didn't mention about the rape or the baby killing in my letter,
mm-hmm.
but I mentioned I found 29 guys, 28 other guys from the company. And he everyone knew about the rape. He knew I knew about the rape. I think he felt the bust was coming down. So my mom passed, and we buried her at my dad at Arlington. I drove to Kennedy's house, and I had Google Earthed it before I went, and this guy lives on a gravel road about a mile from anybody in the woods. so I drive out there, and I call Fenton Grainger. I said, Fenton, I said, you're not going to believe who I found. And I said, you know, Kennedy. And Fenton implored. He was almost shouting. He said, take a gun. Take a gun.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. He was still scared of this guy 65 years later. So I'm not going to take a weapon. I, you know, in that kind of situation, it's not going to do me any good. So I because, you know, this guy's nuts. He's going to do something fast. So I drive up, and it's a back in the woods, this little cabin. I walk up, and I knock on the screen door, and a voice yells, get in here. Mm. So I open the door, and I walk in, and there's a bedroom. And it's immaculate. There's a white, tight-sheeted bed, and there's teddy bears all around the room, which is really weird. In the middle of the bed is a holster for a revolver. Empty, no gun in it. So I walk down this hall, and there he is sitting in an overstuffed chair with a blanket over him. His hands are invisible. The room's immaculate. On the leather couch next to him was a black pistol holster with no pistol in it. And I just said, Mr. Kennedy, I've heard about you for years. Glad to meet you. So I stuck my hand out. One hand emerged from the blanket and shook my hand. The other remained hidden the entire time. And he told me that right here is Colt Python. And so I said, yeah. I said, well, I said, I live in the remote Northern California coast some of the year. I've got weapons, too. I'd be an idiot if I didn't have a gun. Mm-hmm. And I sat down right on the holster and interviewed him. And the first hour, it was, you know, just light talk. And then I asked about, my dad said something happened about down Okinawa. And he looked at me and he said, the guy, he got real chilly look in his eyes. He said, I heard about that. I said, yeah. And he said, I heard it was two guys. I said, yeah. They did something real bad to her. I said, yeah. And this is long pauses between each. I'm just staring at this guy. And then finally I asked, did you know who those guys were? And he said, nah.
Hmm.
And he wouldn't go any deeper. But that guy was chilly, scary. He's a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
I think every, I know you guys tell me what Korea and Vietnam, a certain number of people who go in the military are psychopaths.
Oh, I knew him. I knew him.
Sure. Sounds like he just isolated himself from society, obviously, because he wouldn't fit in.
Well, he was a bounty hunter for years.
Oh, really?
Really?
Oh, my gosh.
Man, he... Wow, that's guy. So I'm trying. One of the guys that you talked to, I'm trying to remember. You talked to him a lot, and he had kind of like a museum. Who do you remember?
Oh, was that the captain?
Yeah, I think captain it was a captain. Talk about him.
Well, you know what's amazing is I early on in my quest, I find the captain from the company, and the officers are older, and by that time they're almost all dead. Captain Hagler was a robust man just in his early 80s, my first time I met him. He had a museum to the war in his basement. And he had 2 acres in Fullerton, California. Sometime before I showed up, he had a Sherman tank, a Japanese tank, and he had hundreds and hundreds of items from the war, including the helmet of a Lieutenant Bussard who was shot in the head by a sniper. And you could see the entry and exit hole in the helmet. And he had the sniper's helmet with bullet holes in it. He collected everything. But what was fascinating to me wasn't the objects. It was the letters he had to the families. He wrote to the families of the dead for years. back and forth, back and forth.
And didn't one family member ask him to stop after a while?
One woman said, I can't.
Can't do this.
Right. Can't talk about it.
Now, was that a wife of one of the soldiers, or was it?
It was a wife of, it was a wife of one of the guys.
One of the guys. And so he was saving all this, and the thing that I remember in your book was that the other guys had a problem with him being a souvenir hunter.
Oh, they called him that blankety-blank souvenir hunter.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I mean, Frank, you know, when I met him, he's a heck of a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he admitted. He said, I got obsessed with it. He wasn't as bad as some of the guys said, but he wasn't a saint. But he admitted to himself, to me, that he wasn't a saint either. He was a very complex guy, Captain Hagler. He just died about a year and a half ago as well. It was 92 when he passed.
Wow.
But to write to the families and long, compassionate letters, he was obsessed with. And what was interesting was, he told me, I'm not anti-war, Dale. But he said, if we thought about what happened to the families before we went to war, we'd go to war less often. Because he says, that's the real victims. He says, when you die, it's over. But he says, if you're living with the death of a loved one, it never ends.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's true. It's true. I mean, it's been true in every war ever. Is what he said right there is just true. Every war ever. It's always
very
the families.
Wise that way.
Yeah, that's really good. Now I think I want to get into something. I want you to start talking about Mulligan. That is just so interesting. Tell who Mulligan was and how he was hooked to your father.
Well, he was with my dad on Guadalcanal. And there's a lot of pictures of him and my dad. As a matter of fact, that's the picture I grew up with, is him and my dad. You know, he's a tall, lanky guy, arm around my dad. Everyone was good looking. When you're 18, 19, we're all good looking.
Oh,
right?
They all have such great, yes.
Yeah, we're all good looking.
Yeah. Amazing. Anyway, but I didn't know his name. I didn't know anything. My dad was obsessed with this picture. It was always within sight. When he retired to California, it was in his bench of his woodworking shop in the garage. But, he remembered Mulligan. He was basically carrying on Semper Fi. You never forget. But he never called it Semper Fi. He never talked that way. So when he dies, I go into his bedroom, and I find other pictures of Mulligan. And his name was on the back, Herman Walter Mulligan. So I had a name. So I did a Freedom of Information Act to the government and asked for his file. I started calling guys on the flag, and I quickly learned that Mulligan threw a grenade into a burial tomb on Okinawa. There have been machine gunners on that hill, and it was Hill 27, just outside of Naha. Japanese called it Mount Jokaku, and they didn't know it, but there was an estimated 2,000 pounds of Japanese munitions inside that tomb.
Wow.
When he threw the grenade in, it went off, and every guy who was there, and I found six of them, it was like, there's an atomic bomb, like a volcano. The rocks flew at least a half mile in the sky and started coming down around everybody. I found the guy who carried Mulligan's body. A piece of tomb roof came right down on Mulligan, 3 by 3 foot, crushed him, and he said he was dead on the spot. There was no saving him. But what's weird is he's listed as body not recovered.
Huh.
Is he still listed still that way?
Yes. And my goal was and still is to put a name on his grave.
Yes.
And here's what I think happened. My father was, at that point, was a squad leader. He was just a step below a sergeant. He was a corporal. And I think my father felt guilty. He said when he talked about my, he wasn't at fault. He said, I think either he ordered Mulligan to throw the grenade or in an effort to stop the bleeding, took off his dog tags from his neck.
Yes.
And he said, he kept saying, one thing my father did say, I blanked up. You can imagine the word.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
I blanked up, but, they made me sergeant anyway. And I think it was Mulligan. So I think Mulligan is buried as an unknown in the Punch Bowl Cemetery.
In Hawaii.
And I wanted to find relatives to get DNA. I want to put a name on his grave. Mm-hmm. This wasn't about the book ever. I don't care if it's 20 years from now and some relatives can. I want to get to the Hickam Air Force Base recovery unit. I want to get DNA. There's 300 unknowns on Hawaii from Okinawa. They said, we exhume all the time. We will put a name on his grave. And that's my goal, really.
Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to about the story of him. And your father thought he, that's where I got kind of a little confused. I kept going back and reading it. And your father, boy, for some reason, he really hooked onto that. He really, really thought that he had killed that man. And do you think he thought he killed him, or do you think he felt guilty because it was... He died.
Yeah, it was clearly guilt. Every guy I found said, nobody blamed your dad. Frank Palmisani, he was there, and he knew the most about the backstory. And apparently, some lieutenant, they had intelligence, go around the tombs. There's munitions in them. the word is, you know, in combat does not get around everybody.
No.
It's not like a well-orchestrated, you know, it's chaos.
It's not like the movies, no.
Not at all.
Exactly. Exactly. So my dad, being squad leader, may have felt ultimately responsible for ordering them to throw the grenade. My dad was a BAR man.
Mm-hmm. Browning automatic rifle.
Browning automatic rifle, and he was surely had the weapon trained on the tomb. Although, again, in a blast concussion, people don't remember exactly details like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one common thing about blast concussion I found from all the guys who went through it. Most of them did, as you say. The immediate minutes, hours afterward are just a state of, you don't remember. It's your brain is scrambled. So my dad probably wasn't even clear himself on exactly what happened. And of course, he tried to blot it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
But Mulligan is interesting. Mulligan is from South Carolina. He's a textile family. He was actually a textile worker himself. His father vanished from the scene. His mother had died in her 30s in 1940.
Wow.
And he had lived with his grandpa. He was half Jewish and half Irish. As near as I can tell, he's the only Jewish fellow that was in the company. Mulligan is not as a common name. His mother's name was Patterson. Owens, excuse me. And so I called hundreds and hundreds of Mulligans and Owens, and there was a Patterson connection to no avail. I went to South Carolina. I dug around. I couldn't. There's his aunt's kids are still, you know, they had kids. There's a branch of the family. I'm a good reporter, but the names were so common, and I sent 250 letters to likely people as well who didn't have phone numbers.
Mm-hmm. Any answers?
Many answers. We wish you luck in your quest, but we're not related.
We're not the ones.
We're not it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping one of them reads the book.
Oh, boy, I hope so, too. So when the after the explosion and Mulligan was taken away, he had to be taken to grave registrations because that's what we did with dead guys. We took them to grave registrations. And so from grave registration, through your digging and looking back, what happened from that point on to Mulligan?
Well, they took him down to the medical battalion, but mm-hmm. as Joe Rosbach told me, he was dead. He would have been then, of course, taken to the quartermaster corps, the grave registry. But mm-hmm. but what I found was when I went to the National Archives, the Marines not only were Spartan, they didn't keep records, they destroyed a lot of the records.
Oh, sure.
Oh, boy.
The archivist at the National Archives was still bitter. He said, they didn't send them. They didn't send them to us. And again, no paper trail. I can't say they were purposely destroyed. But there's something about the Marine mentality to just, at least in World War II, I don't know about later, not to document and to get rid of records. So a paper trail is almost impossible to find.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it exists that I know of.
Yeah, probably doesn't. And so you after you found that he died and can't find his body and they think it's in the punch bowl there in Hawaii, your story doesn't end. Your story keeps going on. And you went to Okinawa.
Yes.
Can you talk about why did you decide to go to Okinawa and what happened?
Well, I had several reasons. And one is my father had a trunk. As a matter of fact, it's about 20 feet from where I sit right now, the same trunk. In our attic, when I was a kid, my mother would boost me up there through a little hole in the ceiling to get boxes for Christmas presents to throw them down.
Mm-hmm.
There was a trunk up there. And I was, you know, 8, 9 years old. I lifted the lid, and it was full of documents and things from the war, including all these items in Japanese, and a passport of a fellow. And I just always figured, how'd my dad kill this guy? He got his passport. There was a wallet that was connected to the passport. The passport showed that he'd visited a brother in Lima, Peru, and the wallet was made in Lima, Peru, and there was things in it. I decided I'm going to go try to find these families.
Mm.
So, and also I wanted to see the places where all this stuff happened, and I wanted to find the tomb where Mulligan died. So I go over in 2011, and I call it the Island of Ghosts. It was the most intense. I've been a reporter for decades. That was the most intense thing I've ever done.
Hmm.
Uh,
Because?
It's the emotion of, there's very few, you know, Japanese survivors, and I found them. I talked to one of the most chilling ones was Mrs. Onishi.
Yes.
One of the civilians. She fled ahead of the Marines as they went south. There were 16 family members when they left Naha. 13 were dead by the time they got to the bottom of the island, just about, I don't know, 12 miles later. And again, they were all killed by naval and aerial shells.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just, her story was intense.
And you talked to her.
Oh, gosh, yes. And she still has scars in her leg from where a naval shrapnel shell hit her and killed a bunch of her family members.
Mm. Wow.
So there was that. I found the tomb site. It's still blown out. It's all built up around there. A rebuilt tomb is next to it. And then I found the family of the man in the passport. And that is the only humorous story out of that trip. And just briefly, I go up to the lot where the house had been. His name was Seichi Zayasu. And it was the northern tip of Okinawa. And across the lane was a house that had the name Zayasu on it. So I knocked on the door. And this elderly guy answers, and he turns out he was the nephew of Seichi.
Hmm.
And I said, I think my father killed your uncle. And he looked at me like I was insane. He said, he died in 1952.
Oh.
I said, what? He said, the family fled to the mountains when the Americans landed. And there was one of the few houses standing in the little village of Akuma. Turns my dad went into the house and stole the passport.
Oh, boy.
He didn't kill the guy.
Yeah. All those years you thought he had killed this guy.
Oh, you know, it's so, you know, you got to have one light moment. And I met the son, and, you know, I gave the items back. I gave everything back that I could give back to the family.
Uh-huh.
And so there was, but then there was Mr. Yamada.
Yeah, talk about him.
Oh, he was, you know, ahead of the Marines as they headed south on the island. He was one of the boy soldiers, the Ketsu Kinotaya, pronounce that properly in Japanese. And he's one of the, like, out of 110,000 Japanese troops, he's like one of the 7,000 who lived through it. And his friend Tatsuya was killed by an American naval shell. He was going to commit what they called kirikomi. And that's what we call a bonsai attack is really kirikomi, which is to basically die fighting. And he lived. He became a successful businessman. But what is amazing about him, I went to the southern part of the island with Mr. Yamada, and he took me down this really well-worn trail, which I thought was a hiking trail because it's a beautiful island actually, but it dead ended in the jungle, in this coral rock outcrop, and I realized that it was the feet of Mr. Yamada that had made the trail. Since 1954, up now twice a week, he's been going to the death site of his friend Tatsuo and burning incense and praying twice a week since 1954.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Wow.
So he talked about he had a visitor today, a man trying to understand his father's war, you know, and just, you know, I don't know how to describe talking to these fellows was like, because, you know, they were, you know, Japan had its reasons for being in the war. They were wrong to attack us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we also have, you know, guilt. I get into the book. Mm-hmm. You know, Japan was angry with us for decades.
Before all of that, yeah.
Yeah, Commodore Perry blasted his way into Tokyo Harbor in 1853, forced him to trade with us. There was, and the Spanish-American War, we took the Philippines and Guam, and they really resented that. And Senator Boutwell in 1898 predicted that Japan would attack us someday for basically taking these islands in their backyard.
Mm.
So that was the reason for Pearl Harbor. We never hear that in our history books.
Oh, no, we never read. No, we never. No, no, no. We don't want to talk about what really causes wars, Dale. You know, we don't want to talk about that.
No. It's like, oh, they just, they hated our freedom. They wanted to bomb.
Yeah.
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
No, it was more than that. Again, they were wrong, but we were wrong back then too. So
sure.
It's complicated. So, you know, I don't. You know, my father. Here's what's interesting, guys. My father never hated the Japanese. He sold Japanese tools in his business in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Well, that's... Dad, is that kind of weird? The Japanese sales reps are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no. He says, they were doing what they were told. I was doing what I was told.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
nothing personal to him. So I never grew up hating the Japanese. No. But to hear their perspective, especially the civilians who wanted no part of war, they didn't want to go to war. Yamada, the last thing he wanted to do was fight. And so, you know, there was this you see in the movies this vicious enemy that's typecast as you know, a savage. And they're human just like our guys were human. Sure. They didn't want to be there anymore. My dad wanted to be there. So the words like healing, like, you know, I hate the word closure. You don't have closure.
Anymore. Not after combat.
Never.
You cope, you deal. So I words fail me to but just in total to hear their story, to see the other side, to see the cost of war on humans, Americans, not Japanese. But that's the ultimate message of my book, is the cost of war on humans.
Yes, and it came through, and it was you made that point very well.
It's an excellent commentary on mm-hmm. on the cost of war. Yeah. And I found the book at times gruesome, of course, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of fear and terror, but also I sensed a lot of tenderness.
It was written with love. Except for Kennedy, I love every guy, every person in that movie.
No, and I'm talking about the Marine, that love company. They'd never call it that, you know. But I sense...
A lot of guys did. They
really?
Liked, you know, L Company, you know, in the vernacular of the military that day was Love Company. I don't know what L was in Vietnam. They changed it.
Lima.
See, love is better, you know?
Yeah. I'm with you. I think that's better. So, you know, we only have... We're just about have out of time. And I want to thank you for writing this book. And I hope that a lot of people read it. And I hope that you talk to a lot of other people about what happened to your father, because nothing's like it seems, Dale, in a war.
No.
Nothing's like it seems to be. And you've written a very, very good book, and I think that your father would be proud of you for the book. I really do.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show. You know, when I used to come to Portland quite a bit and listen to KBOO. I had my ex was there. This is some couple years back. But what you guys are doing with the show is a really great thing, and
it's an honor
to be on your show.
Hey, thanks, Dale. And if you have any more, if you're writing another book or article or whatever you think
that would
be interesting, you have my email address. So just let me know. Okay. And again, thanks, Dale. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thank you, Dale.
Okay. It was great being on, guys.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
That was Dale Mahari, who was the author of Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War. And, there's a lot of things in the book that Dale didn't talk about that was so interesting. And if you get the chance to read the book, I would suggest that you get it and you read it. And World War II is not like they said it was. I want to thank Bill and Arlene for coming on today. And you're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. And we'll be back on May 17th at 9 a.m. And I want to say hello to all my friends around the world who listens to our radio show, especially to my pals in Vietnam. And there it is. And talk to you later. Bye.
Dipper,
we are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. I am alone, I am searching, hungering for answers in my time. I am balanced at the brink of wisdom. I'm impatient to receive a sign. I move forward with my senses open. Imperfection in me, my crime.
pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. On this journey through thoughts and feelings, finding intuition, my head, my heart.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 10:01 a.m. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 10 here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on the Radio Zine, host Stephanie Potter interviews Jane Miller, rancher and head of the Oregon Cougar Action Team, about two bills currently being discussed in the Oregon legislature that would relax the ban on using hound dogs to kill cougar. At 11:30, ethnobotanist Gary Nabin speaks on the future of orchards in times of climate change. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still support KBOO Community Radio by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Board Elections 2013. KBOO members, do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you excited about the possibilities for KBOO's future?
Are you an active member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors.
Applications are now being accepted until June 28th, with candidate training on June 30th. To apply, go to kboo.fm/board elections or email kbooelections@gmail.com.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 ILHE Lecture Series on Wednesday, April 24th, when we'll broadcast a talk by Catherine Austin Fitz.
Managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services, Catherine Austin Fitz is also a publisher of the Solari Report. She served as Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner in the first Bush administration, and Managing Director of Wall Street firm Dillon Reed & Co., Inc. Fitz has designed and closed over 25 billion transactions and investments to date and has led portfolio investment strategy for $300 billion of financial assets and liabilities.
Catherine Austin Fitz will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Wednesday, April 24th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/ILHE2013.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, April 19th, 2013. You're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Local news around Cascadia. Nike wants the keys to the region, and Governor Kit Tubber is off to Bhutan to learn more about this thingy called happiness. Amid the week's violence, gun control appears to have federally controlled, appeared to have founded for now. Reps have punted the issue back to the states, which is probably just as well. We're going to speak today with Beau Grosskopf about the nature of violence in America.